At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
I'm going to use the R word right now, all right? I don't want to catch you unawares. Recession is the word, not for you and me right now, but maybe for corporate America. From American Public Media, this is Market Plans. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, this one is the 21st of January. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. We are going to take advantage of a pause in the chaos, a break, if you will, in the global stock market-induced uncertainty of late to talk about a recession. With companies reporting profits this week and last, and with said profits, frankly, not looking so good, there is some buzz out there about something called an earnings recession. By rule, two consecutive quarters of income declines in corporate America. We sent Marketplace's Kimberly Adams off today to explain what an earnings recession might mean for the broader economy and you and me.
An earnings recession, sometimes called a profit recession, is not a big R recession.
An earnings recession is kind of similar to an economic recession in the sense that profits have stopped growing and have actually started declining.
Shiraz Meehan is with Zacks Investment Research.
And many of the factors that give you an earnings recession are effectively the same as you have in an economic recession.
Slowdowns in overseas markets are partly to blame for the lousy earnings. But the main driver is low, low oil prices, which are cutting into some corporate profits. Sam Stovall is with S&P Capital IQ.
Those companies have already started seeing red ink and therefore have attempted to adjust to that by trimming their payrolls, cutting back on capital expenditure programs, basically just doing anything that's going to cost them money.
And there's a history of links between earnings recessions and broader economic problems. Stovall says since World War II, 10 out of 13 such profit recessions led to real recessions. But he says not to worry.
Well, our belief is that this time will be similar to the three times when we did not end up with an economic recession.
Because despite global problems, the U.S. economy is mostly doing okay. But we will probably end up with a lot more economic uncertainty. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Thanks in no small part to Martin Shkreli, the guy who bought up the rights to a life-saving drug not too long ago and then promptly raised prices 5,000%. The rising price of prescription drugs has come to the attention of the Congress of the United States. Next week, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee is going to be asking executives from big pharma companies some probably uncomfortable questions. Not the first time, though. In the past couple of months, the industry has found itself in the spotlight. So from the Health Desk, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports on the effect all the recent attention could have on those prices.
There are several factors that influence how much companies charge for drugs. Competitors' prices, the effectiveness of the drug. But University of Chicago's Rena Conti says here's what matters most.
It's really this perception of what payers are willing to pay for these drugs that drives drug manufacturers to set a given drug's price.
Right. If pharma executives think the public will pay a pretty penny, then that's what they'll charge. But over the last few months, there's been a lot of this.
Nobody in America should have to choose between buying the medicine they need and paying their rent.
That the pharmaceutical industry itself has become a major health hazard to the American people.
This bruising rhetoric from Democratic presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders is a taste of the unwelcome political attention the drug industry has received over the past several months. Former Merck executive Adel Mahmoud says pharma executives must be sensitive to the political moment.
When that kind of political discussion happens, they will have to appear responsive. They cannot just say, we are deaf.
A study has shown historically, as pressure heats up, companies respond. And that may be happening right now. One manufacturer has ditched plans to raise prices, and generic drug price increases overall have slowed. But Mahmoud reminds us, whatever price relief consumers may experience, it's temporary. A more permanent fix, he says, requires more than lots of talk. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the yield on the 10-year Treasury bumped up just a bit. And if you were listening closely to the show yesterday, which I know, of course, you were, you know that's a good thing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Silicon Valley has a problem with diversity. That much isn't really news. What is what's going on in the high-tech pipeline to change that, specifically at Howard University in Washington, D.C., an historically black college where Facebook and Google and Pinterest and a whole bunch of other companies are making the rounds, and where one professor in particular is leading the charge. Bohini Vara wrote about it for Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So talk to me about this guy. Leland Burge is his name, and he's been working on it, but hasn't really had a lot of success, has he, getting diversity into Silicon Valley and engineering?
Yeah, so Leland Burge became the chair of the Howard Computer Science Department in 2006. And around that time, he aggressively started trying to get Silicon Valley companies to visit Howard and recruit and hire his students. And they weren't really hearing him. He wasn't really getting much of a response. And then in 2013, Google showed up at Howard by embedding a computer scientist from Google there to teach some classes. And this year, he has 28 seniors in his undergrad computer science class. And of those, he knows of only two who have jobs lined up in Silicon Valley. And so all this hard work hasn't yet really resulted in much success.
You talk about Maxine Williams, who's the head of diversity at Facebook, who we've had on this program. She visits Howard at some point, and in the course of conversations with her and other Facebook employees, it almost seemed like there was more a conversation about diversity than actually jobs and coding.
Yeah. So one challenge is that companies are going to Howard in part because, you know, Howard has a lot of talented computer science students who right. happen to be black. And so they show up and they want to talk. They kind of want to talk about diversity, and the people showing up at these universities, too, often have titles with the word diversity in them. And so that's their focus. And the students at Howard sort of understandably are like, well, why don't you just talk to us the way you talk to the Stanford kids or the MIT kids or the kids at another university that doesn't happen to be a historically black college. And so students just didn't like it. It left a bad taste in their mouth. I will say that the following fall, last fall, Facebook came back and held more events that were tech-focused, that were recruiting-focused, and the students really liked it and it went over well. So I think these relationships are evolving.
All right, so let's get back to the headline, the title of this piece, Why Doesn't Silicon Valley Hire Black Coders? It's not for lack of trying. What is it for then?
Right. So there are a couple of reasons that I identified through reporting on this story. One is that there are still maybe some unconscious biases present at companies that recruiters or hiring managers just aren't aware of. And companies are trying to educate their employees in these biases that could influence the way people look at job candidates of color. The other thing, though, is that it's true that a lot of historically black colleges have focused in the past, and this is true especially of Howard, on sending kids on to master's degrees or PhD programs, which requires teaching classes and things like theory. Silicon Valley wants kids who just know how to code and know how to code really well. They want like hardcore programming skills. They want these people to be doing projects in class where they're building apps, building software programs. And so Howard hadn't done that in the past and is just starting to do that. And so kids who are seniors now may not have gotten a lot of practice in these skills. Kids who are freshmen and sophomores at Howard are starting to get that practice. And so I think in, you know, if we talk again in 5 years, I think some of these things will have changed.
Wahi Navara is a contributor to Bloomberg Business Week. She's got a piece, the cover story, in the most recent issue called Why Doesn't Silicon Valley Hire Black Coders? Wahi, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
I would argue that we're not helping Detroit. Detroit is helping Shinola.
Making watches in the Motor City. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 115 points today, 0.7%, closed at 15,882. The NASDAQ gained 0.5%, 9 points, ended things at 1,868. NASDAQ basically flat, ended where it started, 44.72. Among the positives, oil prices were up for change to nearly $30 a barrel. And Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, hinted more stimulus may be on the way. Financials, however, were not feeling it. Bank of America tossed off more than 2%. Morgan Stanley reversed 1.8% today. Over in earnings land, Verizon bundled up a gain of more than 3% after reporting better than expected results. Competitor T-Mobile, which cheekily launched a drinking game to help investors endure Verizon's endless earnings call, was down 0.2%. Speaking of earnings calls, by the way, United CEO Oscar Munoz joined his company's call just 2 weeks after a heart transplant. Profits less than expected, but the stock up 0.4% anyway. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, has set a goal of giving flu shots to 90% of all healthcare workers by the year 2020. Only a handful of states require flu shots for healthcare providers at the moment, and even then, it's only for people who work in hospitals. The flu costs about $7 billion a year in this country in sick days and lost productivity. So enter now the idea being floated by some companies of mandatory flu shots for everybody. Marketplace's Sally Herships takes it from there.
You know what sucks? The flu. Also, if you spread it to your coworkers, you.
You can actually be actively infectious and have no symptoms.
Bruce Lee teaches international health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He says if just one worker gets sick,
if they miss one day, then that's on average, 8 hours of lost productivity to the workplace.
The Department of Health and Human Services says we miss more than 100 million days of work a year, thanks to the flu, which is why some companies want mandatory flu shots, but some workers don't.
So it comes down to, if employees resist, what do you do?
Ivo Besica is an employment lawyer in Philadelphia. He says some workers are under a misconception. The flu shot will give them the flu.
Others, you know, have more of a personal liberty objection, and they say, how can my employer do this? Well, short answer to that is the employer is not the government.
In other words, private businesses often have more leeway on deciding policy than Uncle Sam, except, of course, if workers need to be exempt for health reasons or for religious beliefs. Andrew Challenger is with employment consulting firm Challenger Gray and Christmas. He says the flu is an expensive problem, but it's not like those headline diseases, the scary ones. Just think back to the Ebola epidemic.
All we heard about for weeks on end was Ebola and how worried everybody was about what that could do to the economy.
But he says the flu has a simple fix. Its cost can be erased with just one shot. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Along the lines of Sally's story, there is in this country a shortage of physicians, especially primary care docs, particularly in the South. But Lauren Silverman reports from KERA in Dallas, the laws of supply and demand don't really apply here.
In just a few years, new medical degree programs in North, Central, and South Texas will all be open, adding hundreds of new doctors to a state with a severe shortage. Problem solved? Not really.
Increasing the number of doctors, that term needs to be deconstructed.
Dennis Angelis is a researcher at the Texas Health Institute. He says the key isn't how many doctors you churn out, it's what kind. He says what states like Texas need most are doctors who go into family practice and treat folks in underserved areas for chronic conditions like obesity and hypertension. But that isn't where the money is.
People come out with such debt that they are pushed into the allure of specialty surgery, spinal surgery, anesthesiologists, radiologists, all these others, because that's where the big money is.
Last year, across the country, the average specialist earned $284,000. The average primary care doc, $195,000. So selling recent graduates on family practice isn't easy, even if there's a lifetime supply of lollipops.
Jeremy, good afternoon.
Yeah, good to see you.
How are you doing? Good to see you again.
Yeah, been a while.
So how's school going?
Dr. Matt Simon has been a pediatrician in Dallas for 4 years. He went to medical school in Texas and did his residency here.
There's no pediatrician that I know of that's going hungry or that doesn't have a home. But financially, taking this job was not the right decision at all. But it's a decision that is proved fruitful in other ways.
And get this, Simon is working in the very same office he used to visit for his checkups as a kid.
All right, open wide. Close your mouth.
This afternoon, he's talking with patient Jeremy Thomas about vaccines and exercise. At 22, this will be Thomas's last visit with Dr. Simon, and they're both a bit nostalgic. Simon says yes, he liked the adrenaline of working in the ER and the higher paychecks, but this gives him a chance to create long-lasting relationships with patients.
That's what I enjoyed about it. It's not always a glamorous position, but I think it's one of the most important ones.
Especially as healthcare shifts to a focus on prevention. Linda Green, a professor of healthcare management at the Columbia Business School, says higher reimbursements for primary care docs could help recruit future graduates. But there's a more immediate fix to the doctor shortage. It's called teamwork.
Allowing nurse practitioners to actually practice the full scope of their abilities. There are a bunch of states that don't allow that.
More states are allowing nurse practitioners to treat things like flu and strep throat, so primary care doctors can take on more patients. Add to that idea, doctors working in small group practices instead of on their own, and Green says you could significantly reduce the shortage.
And it's better for the physicians. They have someone who backs them up, who knows their patients. And particularly in this day and age, when we have more and more electronic medical records, The other physician can easily see the medical history of the patient and what's been going on.
If patients expect to see a doctor in a timely fashion, Green says we'll need to rely on more primary care training, better technology, and teamwork. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
I mentioned yesterday that President Obama had gone shopping while he was in Detroit this week for the auto show. He went to a place called Shinola. It's a luxury goods company that makes all kinds of things. High-end watches, though, are its real moneymaker, which is good because Shinola's story is, as it happens, all about timing. It's also today's installment of Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Yeah, so about that timing thing, just 4 months before Shinola began making its first watches, in a building literally in the shadow of General Motors' original headquarters, Detroit filed for bankruptcy protection. The company has been called a sign of hope for that city and its manufacturing base. It's also been criticized, though, as nothing more than an out-of-touch luxury brand with a clever marketing scheme. So I went out to Shinola headquarters not too long ago and met up with CEO Steve Bach for a look-see.
We've gone from 4 people 4 years ago to a company now with 425 odd people and growing every week.
How many here in Detroit?
Just north of about 260.
I read a piece about you guys and what you're trying to do, and I guess it was you who was quoted, who said, you know, we're trying to build a lifestyle company.
Right, this is a design-driven company, so all the products need to fall under the umbrella of design. And, of course, you know that Shinola comes from a shoe, was a shoe polish company,
right? I do. My mother, who's listening to this, would, when I was a kid, she would say, oh, that person doesn't know bleep from Shinola.
Yeah. Right? I'm sure there's going to be a bleep
on that
one.
We'll take care of
right?
that, yeah.
The concept is bring back as much of the capability of manufacturing back into the United States. So the idea of building watches in the United States, something that went away basically 40, 50 years ago, bring that capability back. But if you can do that, why not do small leather goods? Why not do bicycles? Why not do journals? We have Shinola Cola. We have to get you some Shinola Cola.
Shinola Cola, seriously?
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, we can't go into competition with Coca-Cola and Pepsi at this point, at least. But why not have that?
So you got your $10 watch that I can get at Rite Aid, and you got your $750 watch that you have on your wrist. What's the difference?
Well,
they both tell time, right?
Well, they'd certainly both tell time. You'll have to reinvest in a $10 watch probably 1,000 times over the next couple of years. What you're getting here is a watch that really has some gravitas to it. What we've done is we partnered with a company out of Switzerland, a movement manufacturing company. It's an independent company.
A watch movement manufacturer.
Correct.
Got it. Okay.
And, of course, movement is what makes the watch work. It's the heartbeat of the watch. And in this partnership, they have provided us with the equipment, all of the Swiss technology, and all of our staff today is trained on the most current Swiss techniques of building a watch. And there are people working here who came from the automobile industry, pizza delivery, policemen, you name it, every walk of life.
When I look over there, that is actually the assembly plant, as it were, over there. Right?
So
I mean, those people are making watches.
Those people are building watches.
Wow.
And we need to take you through there.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to have to make you look funny now.
That's all right.
So hairnets.
Hairnets.
Shoe covers.
Do that.
And jackets.
All right.
So.
Cool. So this is really very, very interesting. This is where we're making leather straps.
Just watch straps, right?
That's exactly right. Next year, we will produce in excess of 300,000 leather watch straps out of this facility.
That's a lot of watches. It's worth a note that the music is all Motown, by the way, that's playing it.
Isn't it good?
Yeah. It's worth a note.
Isn't the atmosphere wonderful?
Is she seriously painting the edge of every one of these?
Correct.
What's your name?
Myra Mosley. Mosley.
What are you doing?
We actually, after they come, the pieces come from pressing, we actually paint the edges.
Wow.
All by hand.
How many of these do you do in a day?
My highest is 537.
Is that a really good day?
Yeah, that's a really good day.
The pressure was on?
Yeah, I was actually trying to hit a goal.
How long you been working here?
I've been hired here since May 1st.
May 4th, what'd you do before that?
I was at Chrysler on the line.
I can't imagine a more different setup.
Yeah, it's different, but it's better. I don't sweat here, and my back doesn't hurt. Yeah.
So here's the Henry Ford question, who famously paid his workers $5 an hour so they could afford to buy his cars.
Right.
Can the folks over there putting together these watches afford a $750 watch?
Absolutely. When you go and speak to them, you'll see many of them have not one, but many watches.
Oh, and here's the assembly.
Yep.
No Motown playing in here. If these guys have too much coffee in the morning, they got all jittery, they probably can't come to work.
Man. Yep.
When's a good time for me to ask you a question?
You can ask me at any time.
Can I really?
Yes.
May I ask you your name, please?
Sarah.
Sarah what?
Sarah Shoemate.
Okay, first of all, how are you doing this teeny tiny work without a magnifying glass?
Well, we're trying to know what to look for and how to properly pick it up.
Can you tell me what you're doing?
Yes, I'm actually assembling the calendar portion of it.
So there's a tray of what, like 18?
Well, this is actually 11 pieces, including the calendar.
And you're putting them all together?
Mm-hmm. I'm putting them all together.
All right, I'm going to ask this question because the big boss told me I could ask this question.
That's fine.
Do you own a Shinola watch?
I do.
God. How many?
Two.
Get out of here. That was a setup. That was totally a setup. Are you kidding me?
Not at all. No setup.
Two.
Oh, man. That was a total setup.
Thanks.
Get out of here. Two. Do you worry at all about the vibe now that nobody under the age of 32 wears a watch because they just pull out their phones and that's what they're doing?
It's a myth. Total myth.
Oh, yeah?
Look at it. I wear this.
You're not under 32, man. Okay. I mean, come on.
Well, there's something wrong with you. Well,
are you guys profitable?
Not today. No, that'll come in the next 18 months.
Fingers crossed?
Absolutely. Always. For many different reasons. Absolutely.
So here's the marketing and PR question about Detroit, right? I understand what you're trying to do in bringing back part of this city. I mean, no one company can do it all. How much, though, of what you are doing with Detroit is really just PR and marketing?
Well, let's put things very much in perspective, all right? So we're a tiny little piece of the puzzle.
Right.
I would argue that we're not helping Detroit. Detroit is helping Shinola. It's absolutely the reversal. It is the pride that we have in being here, the pride of the people that are working for us, that they show in their dedication, their drive, the quality of their work. It's that combination that has made us successful. Now, of course, we're babies. This is really early days, right, in the evolution of this company. But it's that base that's been so important. But it's Detroit that has helped Shinola, not the other way around.
You can hear my extended interview with Steve Bach on our Corner Office podcast, available, of course, wherever podcasts are sold. We've also got a video and a whole bunch of pictures of the Shinola plant on our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which redemption comes to an NFL referee. If you saw the Packers-Cardinals game last weekend, you might remember the coin flip at the start of overtime. The coin flip where the coin didn't actually flip. After a do-over, the game ended badly for the Packers. The ref in question did all right, though. There is word today that Cleet Blakeman has been chosen referee Super Bowl 50. I just think that's a nice little story. Alrighty, we got to go. The Dow up 115 points today, 0.7%. The NASDAQ gained 0.5%. That is 9 points. The S&P 500 pretty much flat, ended right where it started. And we'll take that. I'll tell you what. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Oscar Gomez was a Chicano student activist in the 90s, a radio DJ, and a rising star.
He was fire. He was charisma incarnate. Everyone had a crush on him.
He was a voice of people who didn't have a voice.
Until his sudden and mysterious death. What happened to Oscar? Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.